Hi, I'm going to start. I'm not going to let you get me off my job today. Welcome to Brave Space Live, a podcast where we talk about anti-oppression and communal healing and all things for all folks. I'm Tyshelle, and I am a DEI practitioner, consultant, educator, lifelong learner, and this is my co-host.
Hello, I'm Mel. I'm an author and a social ethicist. It's great to have you all here with us.
Awesome, awesome. So I'm going to tell you what our topic is for today, even though if you've been following us and on our website, you see the topic. We'll be talking about Indigenous rights, sovereignty, and the issues facing the Native and Indigenous community. And we here at Brave Space, when we talk about topics, we want to hear from folks with lived experience in those topics, much like last week and some other weeks coming up. So stay tuned for those episodes. So we wanted to bring on actually a friend of mine, and Mel is going to read their bio, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I know them. Take it away, Mel.
Gator Lone Wolf was born in South Carolina near the ancient lower towns of the Cherokee, where his ancestors lived. He's been a civil rights activist for 20 plus years and has worked for the equality of Indigenous people across the country. Gator is a member of the American Indian Movement and stays active in events across Turtle Island. In addition, he is the co-president of the Native Indigenous Employee Network Resource Group at a healthcare company and serves as a co-pastor at Unity Fellowship of Owensboro, Kentucky. Gator has a wonderful husband and an amazing son that are his world, and he loves to fish, hunt, and partake in Cherokee traditional ceremonies when he is not working. So welcome to the show. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Before we bring him on, I just want to say I used to work at that healthcare company with Gator. And one thing that you'll get to experience, Mel, and one thing that I got to know is something that somebody shared about Gator with me. They said, I love Gator. He speaks with such power. And to me, I reframed that because after knowing him and getting to know him and work with him, and often he'll be, serving, I don't know sports, but volleyball, serving the ball, I would be, spiking it or whatever. And they said he speaks with such power. And I said, actually, I feel like he speaks with such peace. So you'll hear it in his voice. You'll hear it in how he talks about the community that he's a part of, cares for, and all of the things. So now can we welcome Gator Long?
Yes, we can. Welcome to the show, Gator. It's so great to have you.
Oh, you're on mute.
Oh, let's unmute you. Oh, no.
There you go.
Y'all can hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
So I want to say Wado, thank you. And for that very, very kind compliment, Tyshelle. And it's a pleasure to be with y'all.
So, Gator, I know we're going to get into a lot of topics, talking about the Indigenous and Native community, probably even what you prefer to be called and what, different tribes that you know of are called. But just, we would love to hear a little bit about you outside of including the bio that Mel read. So just tell us a little bit about you, what you care about, who you are, so our guests can get to know you. Anything that you'd like to share.
Well, sure. I've been around for a while. We start there. Like the bio said, I was born in South Carolina, right near the ancient lower towns of the Cherokee. For any of those of you who are looking at me right now, you're saying to yourself, maybe he doesn't look stereotypical Native American. And you're right. I'm a mixed blood. So I'm French, Cherokee, and Shawnee, as well as some other Indigenous. Identify as Cherokee. That's the majority. I have worked, like the bio said, in civil rights, and that's from LGBTQ, racial equity, including Indigenous rights for 20 plus years. My husband and I were two plaintiffs in the Supreme Court case for marriage equality back in 2015. I currently lead or associate pastor at Unity Fellowship, and we're an all-affirming and inclusive congregation. And I also work for said healthcare company as the co-president of the Native Indigenous group. And I'm also the only one who's doing any Indigenous recruiting for said company. And so I leave tomorrow morning again for Eastern Oklahoma to visit some tribes and help recruit folks. So that's a little bit about me. I love the outdoors. I find my healing, if you will, through being outdoors and through music. And so I think that's a good way to start it off.
Yeah, and I was going to say Mel actually has a background in you have to tell theology. So she has a master's of divinity. I'm sure maybe you all had mentioned that. So when I told her, I was like, oh, I have a friend who is and a former colleague who is indigenous, and I believe he's a pastor and all of those. She was like so excited to have you on, and we were both excited. So very, very happy to have you talk to us today. And I know from working with that, with your employee network resource group, how much you care about this work, especially in the workplace and in for Native folks and being able to secure family sustaining jobs as well. So I love that you talked about your recruiting efforts. I follow you on LinkedIn, so I always see when you're going in to South Dakota and Oklahoma and folks onto reservations and gaining that trust so that people can know that these jobs can be there for them, and making sure that we up the numbers, but make sure that we have a family sustaining, and also that it's inclusive when we talk about DEI practices and things like that. So thank you so much. So Mel, I'll let you start with some of the questions that we have for Gator, and just be able to chat.
Absolutely. So we were talking about this a bit before the show. We could do an entire season on Indigenous issues and needs and rights. So we're trying to narrow it down a bit. So Gator has agreed that the thematic that can tie all of this together is what Gator and communities that he works with wish the general United States public knew about Indigenous issues today. What do Indigenous folks wish everyone else knew about Native issues? So that's kind of what we're going to go for today. So we'd like to open it up right now, Gator, with just kind of asking you a blanket question, and we've got a bunch of follow-up questions. If you could just summarize what you wish folks would know about Indigenous issues right now, what would you say?
She started with a big question.
I did. We're going big.
She said, let's start big and bring it in. What are some things you wish folks know?
Yeah,
so I'll narrow it down. So
you don't need to speak for everybody.
Yeah, and I can't. So let me just make that statement in the beginning. So my history is with the Southeastern tribes. I have many friends in other tribal nations. So there's 574 federally recognized tribes in the United States. And then you have state recognized tribes. But don't forget, there's tribes that were wiped out through colonization that we never knew about. Mm-hmm. So number one, Native Americans are not a monolith. So what Gator is sharing may not be what somebody else feels is the most important. So this is from my journey, from my walk, from my shoes. So I don't have one thing that is number one I wish people knew. I have several. I think understanding that we are still here, that we're not relegated to John Wayne movies, that John Wayne didn't kill us all off, that we're not relegated to mascots, to costumes, and that our culture has been here not a few years before Columbus got lost and we found him, but for 20,000 plus years, mm-hmm. our people were indigenous to what we call Turtle Island, now today, Mexico, United States, and Canada. So realizing that, and then realizing that we're all individuals, and that to be authentic natives does not mean we have to still live in teepees and shoot bows and arrows, and that we're as contemporary as anyone else, but our culture and our traditions and our ceremonies are at the core of our identity, above the jobs we have, the money we make, and the status socially. All those things are down the line for us. Family, tradition, ceremony, relationships are number one for Indigenous folks.
I love that.
That's beautiful. That. You know, it's interesting too, speaking from a white perspective, I see a lot of people, white people, treat cultural identity as if it's fixed in time, and that in other cultures, quote, other cultures are not allowed to evolve. Like, right. like you said, you know, people are allowed to live in different types of structures, or you use different tools or different weapons. It doesn't mean that they're any less culturally involved, right? It's that's a stereotype I think a lot of people hold, and I've probably been guilty of that myself. So it's yeah it's a really good reminder.
Well, thank you. I think, and Tashiel, we've talked about this before, that in the United States dominant culture, the minority, the marginalized, are seen through a reflection of a colonized mirror. Mm-hmm. So the mirror is, for us, is frozen on when we were put onto reservations. It's been frozen there. That's how we're depicted. Often, Black folk are reflected through their 400 years worth of slavery. It's like right. Black folk never existed before that.
Right.
The cultures all just magically came after the white folks set them free. So what we do, Amel, to your point, I don't want that mirror there. I want people to be able to look at me, to look at Tashiel, to look at you without a colonized reflection of who they were told we should be.
Right.
So that's real important. And that takes, that's not a conversation that can do that. That's years of getting to know people one-on-one. And so, but that's the fun of life. I mean, getting to meet new people and learn new things and say, I thought this, but you're saying this, and learning, like Tashiel says, lifetime learner.
Exactly. I think too, when we think about that, and I'm so glad that you said that. And when we talk about Black folks, because I often, you know, that's the reason I got into doing DEI work, because in high school we did world history and American history. And then during February, we talked about, you know, what we call the big six, like the Harriet Tubman and Martin Luther King. And that's the only lens that you see them through abolition, through slavery, through enslavement in these journeys, but not us coming over here to teach people math and science and building and all of the things that happened and the travel that happened there, you know, mm-hmm. throughout, and being able to be our own, you know, because we're depicted as lazy and or savage, and what that means to who we are. And even our cultural reflection through television, like being able to tell some of our own stories helps change that, and really getting to know people and be able to be close. And it's something that I don't think that I knew a lot about, because, you know, I grew up in the time where we were in kindergarten and it was like Thanksgiving and they made a cornucopia and you were a pilgrim or you were an Indian. And it was just like, and I think about that now and I cringe at the thought of what that means, even how we think about, you know, 4th of July, how we think about Thanksgiving and all of these different things that we get to learn more, and not that we are burdened by learning the truth, that we get to encourage and engage and learn more.
Exactly.
So much.
So our first question for you, or I guess the second question would be, what in your opinion is culturally important to Indigenous people? I know you said some things earlier. Did that question already encapsulate that, or is there anything else you'd like to add there?
So, you frame that differently. So what's culturally, did you say important to us?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So for me, for a Cherokee of mixed blood, because let's talk for a minute about that. Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's stop for a minute and say that. You will often hear in Indigenous communities, full blood, mixed bloods, full bloods, mixed bloods. And some people even use some more disparaging half breed, those type things. Mm-hmm. That is all born from colonization that set individuals against each other for profit within the tribal system. So they would get those who could speak English, who were most often those of mixed heritage, to read treaties, read them wrong, so that full bloods would sign. And they began to equate mixed bloods with this progressive colonization agenda. And unfortunately, for some, that has held on through the generations.
Wow.
And so there's that deep resentment and suspicion of those who don't look a certain way, talk a certain way, or even those who go off to college and come back.
Right.
So just a little moment on when you hear me say mixed blood. So culturally important, I would say number one is family. And family is much larger for indigenous. I think it's very similar, although I'm not African-American, but to the African-American experience of family that extends beyond the blood and lineal lines to people who are just integral to your life. And that includes many elders. And so in our culture, elders, they are revered. They are taken care of. They are looked to for wisdom because they have gone so much further down the road than any of us have. And they've seen so much that their knowledge and their wisdom are seen as gifts to us. So we don't understand the burden of age that maybe some in the dominant culture try to project it. Taking care of somebody who's aging is a great burden. It's tough, but we see it as an honor because they are our elders, right? So it's a little different way of looking at it. So family and that extended family is very important. Our, I will say, spirituality, not religion. So for, remember when I was talking about mixed bloods, I said full and mixed. You have traditional natives, and then you have what we may call contemporary. And no cut in saying either one of them. But the traditional still practice the original spirituality. And so our spirituality is not something we practice on one day of the week. It is the way we view everything. So our spirituality is the way we live. It's not a practice. So that's very important for a traditional native. And then lastly, not lastly, but what's culturally significant is that our culture remain and not become so assimilated that it becomes the dominant culture. Mm-hmm. And how do we straddle that fence without being labeled militant, being labeled a sellout, right? And that's a very difficult fence to straddle because, unfortunately, a lot of what we need is held by individuals in the dominant culture. And so I think those three things are your family, your spirituality, and then the keeping the culture thriving into new generations who are so often pulled away by social media and pop culture that they find no value in the roots.
When you said that, you talked about that connection that I think as people who lived a racialized or marginalized life, family is so important. And we've talked about this before in that what it looks like to be family being so expansive. Like contemporarily, Black people be like, oh, this is my cousin, and they have no blood relation, right? Because we grow up in a community. And that community has elders, right? And I'll say I grew up in the 90s and I lived on a block. My entire block was my community. Mm-hmm. So the elders were the people who ran programs or what have you, because they are the people. And if you did something wrong, everybody knew before your mom even got home. So it's that sense of community and who is your community, whether you, and it's funny because when I think about that and that expansive thought process, we don't have to share the same last name, but we can stem from this one person, and that community looks really, really big. And that's how we see ourselves, which is so different than dominant culture and the line of individuality in the family is the only people that are inside of your household. In those walls. So thank you for sharing that, because that is something that our cultures share. Yes. And that we see, and that can be harmed by how we engage and have to engage in this hierarchical society.
Very true.
Thank you so much. So
what you said about social media caught my ear, and you're saying so many important things that I could ask you about questions about all of it. So it's interesting that there's this struggle, it sounds like, to, you know, to keep the cultures alive, but still kind of maintain your relationship, for better or worse, with the dominant culture.
Right.
And also maintain your identity without, like you said, being too, in your words, too militant or too passive or too
traditionalist or something like that.
No, you use a specific word, like compromising, something to that degree.
Sellout,
that's the word you use, sellout. Yeah, that's so fascinating. So I've noticed a lot of Indigenous activists taking to social media, especially TikTok. I have learned so much following so many activists from all over the country and actually the world. So really, really cool to see that happening. One of the things I hear a lot of the activists talking about is tribal sovereignty. And I wanted to ask you if you can just give listeners who aren't familiar with that, what that is. I don't think a lot of people know what tribal sovereignty is. And then if you can maybe talk about threats to tribal sovereignty that are happening currently, that would be awesome.
Oh, sure. So tribal sovereignty, I think in this country is hard for people to understand. In different countries in the world, they can relate to it much better, because they have experienced invasion, they have experienced being occupied, those type of things. The common American is not. So when we talk about sovereign nation, we're talking about tribal nations that are sovereign, which means they are self-governing. They administer their own laws, they administer their own criminal justice, they administer their own schools, their own healthcare, on down the line. They're not dependent on the United States to come in and prosecute a murderer, okay, on tribal lands. So those are the type of things that come under sovereignty. We, as Native Americans or a tribal nation, have the right to govern ourselves. And this was drawn up in the treaties. So we now remember there's over 400 treaties that have been initiated through the federal government over 500 plus years. Every one of them has been violated by the United States.
Every single one?
Every one of the 400 have been violated.
Wow.
And so
wow.
When we talk about sovereignty, it's not a closed door, even though it is for us. We have governors, we have congressmen and women who try to undermine that daily. And one of the biggest ones right now is Governor Stitt in Oklahoma. And I'll give you one, for example. Let's say you're on the Muscogee Tribal Nation there in Oklahoma, and you have a child who's graduating high school. They try to come up with a bill to say they cannot wear a feather or any of their cultural regalia when graduating. A state law. When that is the tribe's authority to make rules, regulations, and things, the state has no right to come in and dictate what a Native person wears at their graduation.
And also, why would they try to legislate that? That's absurd. Well, like, why?
Here's the thing, Mel, and this is me, okay? This is me talking. They want to undermine, in any way they can, tribal sovereignty, to, in hopes one day, have the tribes dissolved. Yeah. That's the hope. Because they don't like, I'm using that too large a blanket there, some individuals of the dominant culture do not like tribes having authority over their own, especially when we talk about casinos, when we talk about land rights, when we talk about anything that is a monetary value to the dominant culture. They want that control, and they're going to make it out like the Native folks can't handle their own business. They're incapable of handling law enforcement. They're incapable of handling education. They're incapable of even handling their money. And you know, there's a film coming out in October, a true story, Killers of the Flower Moon, which is a true story about the Osage Nation, who bought land from the Cherokee when they were first moved into Oklahoma. And the white settlers, and I'm when I use the word white folks, I'm talking about colonization. I'm not talking about a whole people, okay? Make that distinction. Were so abusive and forceful to the Osage. They wanted the land, so the Osage sold some of that land, but they kept what's underneath it. And you talk about progressive. And so they sold the top. Then they found oil. The Osage didn't know that, but they knew they were keeping the minerals. So they became overnight millionaires. But the banks wouldn't give them the money. They had to have white overseers divvy up the money to them. And I'm not going to give away the movie, but this heinous true story occurred where families were murdered. I mean, down the line.
Oh, my God.
So
oh
that
my
the
God.
Money would end up in the hands of the overseer. Mm-hmm. So this all goes back to tribal sovereignty. And so, you know, even today when things come up, you know, one of my friends was like, why are y'all getting so bent up out of shape? Can't you just wear a hat like other graduates? Our responsibility is not to mimic you. Our responsibility is to be who we are, not assimilate to you who you are. And so when those things come into play, we have a right to exercise our tribal sovereignty. And again, certain people try to undermine that. And we see that with at Standing Rock, you know, running an oil pipeline through a sovereign nation land without asking any permission, right, without putting any protections in place. We drink water, not oil.
Right.
Okay. And it's this sense of entitlement, I think, that the many Americans just, they can't understand because they're so used to it. Taking what they want when they want it. That's not how traditionally we have been. And we still resist that type of colonization today. And like you mentioned before, Mel, when we see that at Standing Rock, we see it in the Dene Nation, Navajo, where, you know, recently the Supreme Court says, oh, it's not our responsibility to uphold our treaty rights.
Yeah.
To give you water to live on and sustain. So
it's so interesting to me. Sorry, Mel, let me cut you off that.
Go for it.
This thought process, and you touched on it, Gator, of entitlement and ownership, right? And when we think about what this ownership is, it can come down, and it comes down to like the small things that undergird these bigger issues and thought process of assimilation. So when we think about ownership and things like that, I think about every other, you know, American group has a hyphen in it except for white people, right? And even this is white as a large group, but not necessarily every individual person. But when we think about that, to the point where people who were here before that even become a hyphenate, like, and it's so utterly disrespectful. And that is that when we make it so hard, and we have this fight, and I know some of our fights are so parallel for the African American community, because we came here and so many of us have connected in all of the things that we and how we live. But when it's so I want to call it petty, but petty is like the small version, in that you can undermine every single part of a group of people so that they feel like they're forced to assimilate to be mm-hmm. able to live, and then be able then to dissolve, right? So mm-hmm. if I say you can't wear a feather and you're getting a college degree, then you just won't wear the feather. You'll become, you'll assimilate, and then you can, you know, to the point where even, I know I was talking to one of our former colleagues at said healthcare company, and they were saying, I am Middle Eastern, and my grouping under who I am as a person is under white. I'm not white. And so we take it and we make people assimilate into these larger groups to be able to dissolve what their cultural engagements are, who they are, mm-hmm. and that goes into things like sovereignty. So when we think about culture, it seems so petty, but it isn't, because it's everything that we are and how we live. It is our culture. It is living and breathing, you know, how how we live, everything that you talked about, and you talked about spirituality as a part of that, right? All of those things. Sorry, Mel, I didn't mean to cut you off. You were about to say something.
Oh, no, you're fine. My thought was this. I think that as you're speaking, Gator, I think that there is a fair amount of willful ignorance around the concept of tribal sovereignty in the dominant culture. And I mean basically white culture. Like, for example, I don't think many white people would have a problem understanding that if you took the Vatican, which is the smallest country in the world, it's only 100 acres, took the Vatican, Vatican City, it's its own nation. It's got its own sovereignty. It has no overlords. It is its own entity ruled by the Pope, right? If you take that out of Italy and you plop it in the center of Oklahoma, I don't think many white people would have a problem understanding that, like, that is a country that exists separate from the U.S. The U.S. does not have jurisdiction. They can't just step over into the Vatican and do whatever they want. But for some reason, it's just gosh darn difficult for white people to understand that tribal people, tribes have sovereignty over their lands as well. And it really, it speaks to the idea that for the white psyche and the way that white people conceptualize ourselves in particular, manifest destiny in the idea that we have a right over anything native ever is so deeply embedded in the way we think that we will purposefully misunderstand things so we don't have to actually face the reality of this. And I'm thinking of that painting by John Gast. I don't know if you've ever seen it, with the big white woman carrying the Bible, like going from the East Coast to the West Coast, like while all the white people are bringing like light, literally like the right hand side by the East Coast is like full of light. And she's like ushering in the Bible and education to the dark West. And you can see in the painting, he's painted tribal people, native people fleeing in their darkness. Like it's horribly racist, but it's just this idea that like white people can go take land and God told them to do it. There's a deification of that. There's like a nobility in like claiming, you know, what native people should have by birth, right? Like you said, for 20,000 years. And it's, I think when white people really start to grapple with that, it really breaks your brain a little bit because you realize how deeply embedded. Like I grew up playing, like pretending, please excuse me if this is offensive, but pretending to be Indians growing up with my family. Like it horribly offensive. But that was in my lifetime. I'm only 38 years old. This is not hundreds of years ago. This is now. This is happening now, that people think it's okay to treat native people like this.
Yeah, you hit on it. I mean, it's the sense of entitlement. And we, you know, some people, like when they hear land back, they're like, oh, so the natives believe they own the land and we stole it from them. We belong to the land. And I don't know how we could say it much better. The land is our mother. You cannot sell your mother. You can't give your mother away. You belong to her. She nurtures you. She gives you what you need to live. And imagine doing that for generations, millennia, and then having people come. And you, here's what people don't understand. We shared the bounty with the settlers in the beginning. And then we were attacked and we were eradicated and we were lied to, murdered on down the line. And so it's not that we believe we own the United States, but it's that this land is, we belong to it. You cannot take it away from us and then destroy it on top of that. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Just losing it, but now you're destroying it almost to the point of no return.
Right.
And when we fight to defend that, we're terrorists. We're thrown into prison.
Wow. Yeah.
When you said it, it sounds so right to me in when you talk about belonging to the earth, because we came from it, we'll return to it. That, you know, and it's not a belonging thing. I mean, it's not an ownership thing. It's a belonging thing.
Yeah.
And you can think about that. And this is what, when we think about that, when I think about that for the land, which I've never been to, but I belong to, this is, you know, it's home, right? So when I think about the continent of Africa and where I would come from in there, in that we belong to this place and that we nurture this place and we don't exploit this place. We especially don't exploit it for something as trivial as money, because it's, it gives to us all that we need, and we give back to it so that we can continue for generations. And the fact that people want to destroy it for a concept, which is money, and that, you know, Native folks are willing to share in that, right? The bounty of that, and a full circle, full ability to share. And here, you have some. You're hungry, I'm going to feed you. You're sick, I'm going to clothe you. I'm going to heal you. All of those things. But it's like, no, I'm going to put a flag down, and now I own this. Mm-hmm. And now I can tell you what to do on it. And it's just when you say it, it just sounds so like, how does that even make sense? And I know this is the conversation I have. How does that even make sense? Right? Like, how?
American way.
It's also short-sighted, right? Because you're dealing with like the temporary gain of like selling oil or whatever for this quarter. You're not thinking about 10,000 years from now. You're not thinking about the sustainability and the lastingness of how society, how humankind is going to continue. It's completely self-destructive in addition to being destructive to the environment.
Yeah, and Mel, that's so if you ever had driver's lessons, you know, the teacher would tell you, don't look right in front of the hood when you drive. Look out in front of you down the road, right?
Yeah.
Because you're going to come up on something. You won't see it if you're looking right here. Mm-hmm. Natives look 7 generations into the future. Everything we do, we imagine it like a rock dropped in a pond, and those ripples will go out to 7 generations. We're responsible for the ripples we create. And like Tyshell said, traditional natives, when we take, we leave something. Sometimes that's a prayer. Sometimes it's an offering of tobacco. Sometimes it's replacing the item. But you know, like we grew up, we hunted. But when we took the meat, we gave thanks to the deer for the life, and we gave thanks to the creator for the deer. We believe if we don't do that, we will undergo physical harm from the spirits of these. See, we don't see animals. It's just a lot. I'm sorry, in an hour.
No, I love
that. No, it's beautiful. Reciprocity, it's beautiful. Yeah.
You know, we don't see humans as the peak and everything else underneath. That's a European concept.
Yes, it is.
We see human beings as a part of everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're no greater than the bear. Our spirits are no more precious to the creator than the fish. Every piece of creation is sacred. And so our interactions, therefore, take on that responsibility to nurture and care for each other, but also the environment. And when you come in and you drill and you introduce foreign chemicals that were meant to stay below ground and come up, you're ruining millions of years worth of Earth's ability to nurture not only us, but everything else in creation. Mm-hmm. But the dominant culture, and I will say dominant culture, it doesn't have to mean white. There's a lot of natives who have adopted that same outlook, that mm-hmm. it's for me, when I die, who cares?
Yeah.
That type of mentality and that selfishness, if that mentality, it would never survive in a tribal setting. It would never survive because we're all dependent on each other. So I will give you one quick example. If someone in the tribe ever killed someone else in the tribe in anger, something like they were banished. They were banished for 2 to 4 to 6 years. Now, when I say banished, people may think, oh, they're going to be lonely. That was almost a death sentence, most likely, because they would be without who? Without the tribe, without any defense in a land of other tribal nations, animals, all that. So we understand our dependence on each other in a much more personal level than I think many in the dominant culture. They think if I work hard enough. That's right. When it should, I'm not going to say that. But for us, it's if I work hard enough, we can have this. we can establish this. It's the African proverb of Mbutu, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and they tried to tell the children, the African children, they said, you know, the first one who can get to this rock will get 12 cookies. And he said, go. And they all held hands and walked to the rock. Reacher said, you don't understand. I said, the first one to get it, he said, you don't understand. None of us are fed if all of us are not fed. That is countercultural to the very foundations of the United States and capitalism.
It is.
And yes, it is. That's why you see Native indigenous folks, immigrants, Black, any marginalized folks are relegated to what the white culture defines them as. Because to accept mm-hmm. their traditions, to accept what's of value to them, would shake the very foundations of what this nation was built on. Even though we don't recognize it as that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's not the intent.
Americans. We were here before it was America.
Yeah.
You don't define us by what you created.
Right.
Okay, I'm done. I'm sorry.
You get to be your own entity. You don't need permission. You don't need permission.
We've earned that. You don't define us as what you took absolutely. From us and created.
Yeah.
And relegate you to a type... And relegate yes. you to a type of car or a mascot yes. or something. It's just so when you're talking, it's like mind blowing to me, because one of the things, and I'll show you all, I keep a post-it on my desk, and it's my personal motto, but it's my community motto. And it says exactly what you said so beautifully. For me, it's a reminder every day. That's why I look at it. It says, I am both an ancestor and a descendant. Everything I do and am able to do. And I remember this, we were doing one of those tributes to Martin Luther King. This is a golf, not at Martin Luther King, but at the tribute to everybody always wanting to do I Have a Dream speech. And I was asked to participate, and I said, no, thank you, because we got to do something else. And then our super SVP or VP came to me and said, Tashelle, what do you think? And I said, why would you come to me? Because now I got to say something. And my standpoint is never to lie in those situations. So when I was asked what Martin Luther King means to me, one of the things I said was, I am both an ancestor and a descendant. Everything I do is because someone else fought a battle, lived a life, created life, did all the things before me. And so a lot of folks will say, and I'm putting what you're saying into how it really manifests in me, but I believe what you're saying for tribal nations and indigenous folks is everything I do is because I'm a Black woman, right? That's how I live my life. And it was a Black woman before me and one before her and one before her. And I am a descendant of those. And I am an ancestor to the ones that come after me. And my job is to make it easier for them to live and sustain so that they can be exactly who they are instead of being seen through the lens of this American mirror. So when you're saying that, it's just like, it's melting my mind away, because it is exactly what I've been feeling and how I feel about even the work that I do and the how we talk and the engagements that I have. So thank you for putting that so beautifully and reminding me. I'm gonna put my post-it up in my face instead of just on my desk. I'm gonna put it in my face. So thank you. There's so many more things to talk about. Go ahead, Mel, and I can get lost in just this.
I know this could easily be a 3-hour conversation. So while we're on the topic of entitlement, I don't want to forget to touch on this and ask you about this, Gator. This is a very serious topic for people who aren't aware. MMIP stands for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Persons. And Gator, I wonder if you can just give our audience a brief overview of what that means and why that is such a significant issue that tribes face right now.
Sure. It's a modern day genocide. And so you may say, well, that's an exaggeration. Well, let me tell you about it. So throughout the United States and Canada, predominantly Indigenous women, but also children, men, Two-Spirit, are being kidnapped, trafficked, and murdered at unbelievable rates. And this never makes it to the news. Law enforcement rarely, if ever, investigates these disappearances. And our community which, you know, the belief that natives are rich because of casinos is absolutely ridiculous. Majority of us have meager means, but we have had to buy ground penetrating radars with tribal money to search for our mamas, our aunties, our cousins, our dads, whoever, because nobody else will look for them. And I just use this one example. So I'll say two. So I'm members of these different missing indigenous folk groups on Facebook. There's not a week, I'm serious here. There's not a week that goes by that I don't get six new alerts of women or children or men missing just in Rapid City, South Dakota. Just in that city, they go missing. And I have never, ever heard of them being found by law enforcement. Never. I've heard of them being located by tribal members. So when the young woman, Gabby, and I apologize, I cannot remember her name, was murdered by her boyfriend in Colorado. Y'all familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yep.
And there was, if you remember, there was a nationwide manhunt for this.
Gabby Petito.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. For this man, who the boyfriend who had murdered her. And I mean no disrespect to her, but it put it crystal clear who America values in terms of life and who they do not. Because within 100 miles of where she was discovered, over 700 indigenous people were missing. They never made the news, not even the local news. And yet they're as precious to us as Gabby is to her parents and her family. And we can't get anybody to give a damn about it. And we're losing people daily, and children are being trafficked. And so I will share from these groups, these photos and information on these people. And I have some people say, why are you sharing someone who was stolen from Manitoba? We live in the South. People are trafficked across lines all the time.
Absolutely.
So sharing these things and encouraging allies to join these groups and share these photos, that's somebody's baby. That's somebody's granddaddy. That's somebody's auntie. But we've been culturized to look at them as different, right? But they're us, they're our own. But MIP that you speak about is a North American epidemic. And there's MMIW.org, which is Missing Indigenous Women. That's the largest organization. And so we'll have MMIW Awareness Day, where you see red dresses or red handprints on faces. Those signify awareness about these disappearances, these kidnappings. And so much of the law enforcement will simply say these folks came from the tribe for a better life and they've just gone back. And when you say, no, they can't, they'll say, prove it. They've just gone back.
To give some statistics for those listening, so Indigenous women and children are 10 times more likely to be murdered than white women and children in this country and on tribal lands. And murder is the third highest cause of death for Indigenous women in particular. There were over 4,000 cases, MMIW cases, at least this year alone. When you say genocide, and is there any, and we don't need to go into detail about this if you don't want to, but is there any clues as to who is responsible for this? Like, do we know anything about what's happening here?
So I'll tell you this, it's not blame the white person. Many people believe it is a set of individuals of all different races, ethnicities, that prey on those in the margins, especially homeless, because that's where a lot of these women, they're coming from tribal nations where they have no opportunities. They're moving to larger cities to get job and employment. But in that in-between time, these predators know they are most vulnerable. And this is the time they're being stolen and the children are being stolen. and the Two-Spirit are being murdered, and et cetera. So it's this very vulnerable transition between tribal life, which is brutal for some, moving to the city in hopes of having a new start. But this is when they're taken. So I don't know if anybody saw Dances with Wolves, the movie. There was one character on there called Smiles a Lot. He was a young teenage Lakota boy in the movie. Well, his name is Nathan Lee Chasing Horse. He was just arrested in Las Vegas for over 25 years. That man has been predating on Native women and little girls and keeping them in bondage. Oh, and he's God. One of us.
Oh, God.
And he's one of us. So they busted him in Las Vegas. He had given everyone, he got five wives in the house, he claims are his wives, and had them all armed and had ordered them to kill themselves before law enforcement could Jesus. Take them. He was kicked off of Fort Peck for forcing himself on young girls. And he said, here's his defense, they were wanting it.
Oh, God.
There's this type of devaluing of the female indigenous, and it goes right across the lines of marginalized ethnicities, but it is prevalent, and he is a predator, and it has taken, here's the angering part, I'm trying to control my anger, 25 years
right
for the federal government to hear what Native folk have been saying all along. He's killing our women and our children. 25 years, they finally make the arrest, and they want a pat on the back.
I do want to say, one of the things I want to say about what you're saying too, as you you mention him and you say he's one of us as well, is that we also need to understand that no group of people is perfect and should not have to be to seek to be able to receive and be a part of justice. And that's something that the dominant culture sees in so many marginalized cultures. Well, they're doing it to themselves, yes. right? It's the same, the crime, the yes. alcoholism, the murders, anything that happens with inside of a community of marginalized people, well, they're doing it to themselves. So why should we care? But we don't have that conversation about dominant groups. So I want to make that clear in that there will be people who commit murders who are Native. There sure. will be people who commit murders who are Black, the same way there are people who commit murders who are white. There are issues within communities, in any community, but that does not mean we don't deserve justice. And one thing I wanted to say that you, when you mentioned about Gabby, you said her name, and you wanted to find, you were asking about her last name. I literally just typed into Google Gabby, and it was the first thing that came up. Not Gabrielle, not person who was killed. It was literally, I typed in Gabby and it was the first thing that came up. And that's how we know whose life is valued and who is not, right? Because women and children are, among all groups, are supposed to be the groups that are, the people that are valued, women and children. But to have such egregious genocide with missing and murdered Indigenous women and all other folks, I want to group together mm-hmm. That we don't value groups of people that mm-hmm. are, I guess we could say different, but are not the dominant culture. And it's just so many things. We have so many things that we want to talk about. We've gotten to like four of them, but
that's okay.
Thank you. I thank you for shedding light on that. And you said a couple of different, you talked about MMIW.org, and we will make sure we share that on our social media so that people can go learn more. We'll make sure it's in some of our show notes and things like that. And you also talked about the Killers of the Flower Moon, about the Osage, and I'll make sure we share that as well, because we definitely want people to hear from you. But as you said, you are one person, but we also want people to go do their own research and learn more. We have a couple more things we want to talk about, but I wanted to at least say that
as well. Do you mind staying a little bit longer, Gator? We have so many more questions for you. Is that you're good for time? Okay. So I'd like to ask about land back, because you mentioned it before. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of give people a brief overview of what that is and what that means and how they might participate or help Native tribes with that, if that's the correct terminology?
Sure.
Yeah.
The land back movement the overall movement, of course, there's different chapters to it. So it's not like one organization that's doing it. Just understand that. But the idea is that the land that our ancestors grew up on was taken to us through lies, taken from us through lies and threats of violence. And we want a good chunk of that back. And when you say that, you know the response that we get. But imagine this. And I wish I had the graphic that shows it. There's a graphic online that shows from 1760 to the year 2020, the loss of Native Indigenous land in the United States. And it is astonishing. So many people say, well, you got your reservation. Understand that, for example, Pine Ridge Reservation is not known as Pine Ridge Reservation in the federal government. It's known as prison camp. Number dot, 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 dot. All the reservations are known as prison camps in the federal government papers. Now, why were we given those? Because the settlers and the government didn't want the land. They didn't want it. They didn't have anything they wanted on it. So they gave it to us. And I don't think a lot of people understand that the land played a huge part in our cultural identity. So, for example, the Northern Plains tribes, when the white government made the decision to eradicate the buffalo to force the Native American to depend on the United States for government subsidies and therefore give them their land, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. They took away the role of the male Lakota, who was a hunter, who was a warrior, and they relegated that individual to be a farmer. And they even brought cows into the tribal corrals and turned them loose so that the natives could chase them on horseback. Right? I'm mocking a culture that had been around for centuries. And the women who are our Cherokee culture, it was a matriarchal culture. The men married into the women's family. The woman could divorce simply by putting the man's things outside of the home. The children stayed with her. The land stayed with her. Everything belonged to her. Mm. And yet the colonized culture comes in and completely disrupts that and changes it to a patriarchal. And so you have a complete upending of everything that we consider sacred. And so when you talk about land back, you're talking about not only the actual acreage, but you're talking about our roles that were of sacred value to us. And I don't know how to explain that in academic terms to people who need it, but I can tell you that the land I grew up on is sacred to me because my ancestors grew up on it. And the creeks and the rivers that flow from there flow from the places we were created. And you can't just take those and expect our type of people to go on and do nothing. We have a right to those lands. And whether that be a partnership, whether it be co-sponsoring habitation, but the idea of complete and utter ownership where we are left out is unacceptable to us. And that's the land back movement, because we're not going to take that.
So how does that actually work, land back? How does it actually?
Well, we're seeing it in a lot of cases. So, for example, where private landowners are now turning over land back to the original tribal nations that the land was their ancestral home. Sometimes they're paid by the tribe for it, but many times this is donated by woke citizens who are saying, I've made millions off of this land that was stolen. And I've plowed through sacred burial grounds. Right. It's the only right for me to give this back. And then we've had folks like Deb Haaland, the Interior Secretary, who said, get rid of every national monument that has the word squaw in it, which is a derogatory sexual term for Native women. Get rid of it. And then she's introduced Native tribal communities to the table to begin saying, how do we manage our resources in the United States, our natural resources? Because evidently we don't know how to do it. And she's putting power back in the hands of those who were the original inhabitants of the land, the children of the land. And so those are ways that the land back movement is starting to gain traction. But if I had more time, I could explain to you how they systematically stole millions of acres from us through the Dawes Act. But I don't have time for that tonight. But
I have a couple graphics to actually show you. You said the map that compares native lands. So here's the map 1809. And if you can see this on the screen, it's like 2/3 of the United States is blue native land, like 2/3, like from all the way from Florida, you know, all the way up to what state is that? Michigan. Mm-hmm. And then the entire western half of the US. And now today, here's the map. Here's the map. You just have a small spattering of lands, some in Oklahoma, some up in Idaho, a little bit in Arizona area. And again, like Gator said, these are lands that basically white settlers didn't want, right? Yeah. So like these are lands that are highly infertile. They're very difficult to make, you know, to raise crops and difficult water access, inhospitable environments. And this is the other photo you mentioned about the buffalo eradication, literally in the, I believe
you got to pull it up.
The 1850s. Yeah. The 1850s. There was actually a federal decree to quote, kill every buffalo you can. So this is a mountain of buffalo bones, purposefully decimated by white pioneers and settlers. And they're proud of it. They're showing it off. When I say mountain, this has got to be about 30 feet high and maybe 100 feet wide. Of buffalo, which was, you said, Gator, a primary food source, right? For tribes?
The Plains tribes. It was the primary.
Yeah.
And they saw them. And we had timber bison in this area, but they had the Plains bison, and they were seen as relatives. Everything, their whole lives depended on those Tatanka, as the Lakota called them. And when they were eradicated on purpose, it was like their entire world fell apart.
Right, because you take one thing from the ecosystem and it falls apart.
Well, and then we had no food.
No food.
So who would get food from? Federal government. We'll give you food. Now, you know that land you have? Give it to us.
One of the things that you...
Hold on, Tasha. And then when our chiefs said no, they cut off all food to the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And our women and our children were nothing but skin and bones until we signed the paper.
One of the things that you both mentioned about even religiosity and all of the things that go into that is I can think of one, a trip that I took to Montreal, which is still part of so much of native land. And I went into the Basilica of Notre Dame and I saw one of those stained glass windows that was depicting native and African enslaved folks as kneeling and taking on this religiosity, not spirituality, and they were taking the land. And it was in a church in a stained glass window, and it's burned into my mind. And when I think about when we have these conversations for people to understand, you know, there were some things that we wanted to talk about, but I think this is such a rich conversation and real that people don't, that are not necessarily getting and understanding how we are all connected. And it's so interesting to me as Mel, as you showed the map, I just look at the racial line. I look at the state lines and see racial lines, right? This is like, you know, I think Denver and Idaho have these slivers that go into other places because they wanted slavery to continue here and genocide here. And then they shrink where all people can live and go onto. And it was so seared and burned into my mind. So just thank you for illuminating some of that to our listeners, to us, to me. I'm a lifelong learner and I've learned so much here from you today. I'm not trying to get the conversation just yet. I'm just so grateful for this conversation.
Same. Thank you so much. I've got three more questions for you. I don't know if you have any more, Tyshel. Want to make sure to touch on the recent Supreme Court ruling about ICWA. So ICWA stands for the Indian Child Welfare Act. And I know we could talk for 3 hours just about this. So if we can just give a brief overview, and then maybe we can talk about the historical context of why this is so significant. And then Gator, I'd love to hear from you as Gator, what did this decision mean to you, if anything, and how, maybe how your community reacted to this decision?
Well, the Indian Child Welfare Act was an act put into place at very, very high level to protect Native children from being sold out to white families.
Exactly.
Stolen.
Yeah.
I mean, literally paid $5. It's literally $5 you could buy a Native child. And so this act went into place to protect Native children from being stolen from their parents, their tribal communities, their cultures, and et cetera. And the Supreme Court simply upheld that in saying that primarily, we're not saying every time that it's inappropriate for a Native child to go to a white family or a Black family. We're not saying that. But primarily, all resources should be exhausted to keep that child in their tribal nation and give them the opportunity to grow up in their own cultural identity with their own family, with their own values and traditions. That is what that was put into place to do. And we were delighted and shocked that the Supreme Court ruled in favor of it. But that's what is intended to do, is to protect Native and Indigenous children from, in essence, being stolen. And just, they will make social workers in high Indigenous states will make up lies about parents and take the children from them. This is true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
4 or 5 children will be gone overnight, and these children will be adopted, and I'm using air quotes for those listening, out to people in Florida, wherever. And this is supposed to be legal. So this is where this act comes in, to try to stop that illegal market. And I'm using market, and I'm not trying to devalue life, but I'm just saying, hey, welcome to the real world, folks. America is capitalistic, and they have lives of non-white children and women on the market. And that's what this law was meant to stop. And so we're, again, Mel, to your question, we're delighted that it stands, but we need states to have the resources to uphold it. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be more difficult.
One of the things that came up for us too is we had our old colleague Adam on talking about transracial adoption, and we find out that some of that same thing is happening, where they tell a family that this child is going to go to school there, but they use paperwork that the family can't understand or can't read, and takes that child away, and then giving them, and even, and this is something that goes on even into our foster care system, I think, that we should know and understand. How is it that I bear a child, cannot raise them because I don't have enough money, but the government will give you, I'm going to use Mel, money to raise my child, instead of giving me the money I would need to raise my own child. So we really have to think about what even that system is, and then the lies that go in on top of, oh, this person can't care for their child because they are, you know, they use drugs or they're drunk or all of these different things. And it is important to note the, you know, if you want to learn more about ICWA, you should look up the cases that came into that brought it in front of the Supreme Court and why it was such a big deal. And even though those people were still able to adopt that child, it still became a federal case, talking about whose life and whose rights and their ownership and entitlement and being able to be valued, we need to be thinking about. So I am also glad to hear that. Mel, I'm sorry, I cut you off for a second.
Oh, you don't have to apologize. You're fine. I would love to recommend a documentary to everyone. It's called Dawnland. It was actually filmed here in Maine, about the Wabanaki tribe that had a Truth and Reconciliation Council meeting with the government of Maine, because for several decades, Maine Native people, children were being taken out of their home at a much higher rate than white children and being put in foster care, like 3-4 times the rate of white children. And they actually got the governor of Maine on camera admitting this was cultural genocide. We were trying to dismantle on purpose the identity of these tribes and weaken their authority. So taking children out, and they actually have interviewed women, people in their 50s, not even really old folks, but people in their 50s who never were informed that they are Native. This one really heartbreaking story of a woman named Georgina who said that she and her sister used to sit in a tub full of bleach to try to bleach their skin because they wanted to fit in with their white family because they were completely cut off from their tribe. So highly recommend that documentary. But in the documentary, they also talk about the background behind this, because before foster care, it was boarding schools. So again, Gator, can I ask you, it's much better coming from you than me. So the larger context of this and why this is, I imagine, so incredibly painful to talk about rights over children and sovereignty is because of the history of boarding schools. And there are actually people still alive today who were in boarding schools, right? Because they were through the 70s, I think, here in the US, right?
Until 1998.
98? Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Yes, please tell us what boarding schools are. I'm sorry, I have to ask you about this.
No, you're fine. In the latter part of the 1800s, in the early part of the 1900s, there was a campaign by the federal government to kill the Indian, save the man, quote. And the idea was to take indigenous children, bring them to boarding schools, assimilate them to American culture, to American religion, and did this by force. So if the parents resisted, they were either jailed or shot. There were many instances where children would have a designated place to hide. If the parents saw dust coming, you know, from the cars or horses, they would hide the children because they could be taken. Many of these children were taken across the country to places like Carlisle in Pennsylvania, brutalized. Children as young as 2 up to 9 years old were taken to these places, brutalized for speaking their own language. They were often sexually abused, murdered, thrown in shallow graves. Their hair was cut. And when we talk about hair, our culture understands hair as an extension of the Creator. And much of our spiritual powers in our hair, it's connected. So to cut that is to completely gut our identities. And they would burn the clothes that the children were brought to the boarding schools in. Many times these were beaded clothes by their mothers or their aunties. And of course, as I said, they were beaten for speaking their language. They knew no other language, so they could not do the commands that the English teachers, and oftentimes these were Catholic run boarding schools. So these nuns and priests would give them orders. They didn't understand them. They couldn't eat the food. They weren't used to the food. So all of this happening, parents would write, never hear back, would go, would be told a story about the child is away on a field trip. But oftentimes these children, again, were thrown into shallow graves. And this began several years back when they discovered some graves at a former school in British Columbia. And they began searching. And they now have over 9,000 remains of indigenous children that they found. And for us, our community, it's a lost generation.
Yep.
So the trauma that carries over into then the foster care is an extension of this theft and this just complete devaluing of our children, of their lives, of their sacredness. And so we are still searching former boarding school grounds for the remains of our children. And Deb Haaland, Interior Secretary of the United States, has dedicated a lot of budget and resource to opening investigations on these schools and finding these remains. Unfortunately, their remains. These children will never go home. And these parents, many of them are gone now, never knew what happened. So that type of trauma existed. Many people knew nothing about it. Like I said, up to 1997, 98, boarding schools still existed within the United States where they killed the Indian, save the man. And I'll give you two examples of people who were at these schools. One girl was raped by a priest. When she gave birth to the child, it was taken down in the basement and put in the coal oven.
God.
And another young man was so afraid when he was taken, he think he was 4 years old, four or five, that when the priest would scream at them or the nun, he would urinate in the bed. And they tied his foreskin shut with fishing line so that he couldn't. And he got such an infection, it almost killed him.
God.
And he treated children like this.
Oh,
so
God.
That's just a glimpse of Indigenous history in Canada and the United States and why there's still so much mistrust and resentment and bitterness. Mm-hmm. We're not victims. We're not in need of fixing, but you have to acknowledge what we've been through if you ever expect us to partner with you and move forward. Because everything we ever had, everything we ever loved has been taken from us and continues to be in many ways. So,
wow.
You gave such a history, and I think about so much of how you know, blissful and willful ignorance that so much of us live in not knowing, because it's so much easier to not know. And you gave us such a deep history. There's so, I think one of the things, and I'm covering my face, because one of the things I think about is once you remove these rose-colored glasses of what we think about our history in America, and also seeing that people are banning books because they don't want to learn these things, you can't unsee it. And that's part of the reason people are covering these things up. I know, Mel, I don't know if you have any other questions, because I wanted to wrap up more, but I wanted to talk more from a historical joyous framework and the things that you see happening in a really positive light, the things you're joyful about, because, and I know we said this, but even before we jumped on, is that, and you said it as you ended this part of the conversation, not victims and not in need of pity and not in need of charity, but really working together. And some of the things that I've seen you do, one of the things being at our said healthcare company, creating a land acknowledgement was one of those things. And, there was a full ceremony of you blessing and cleansing it and adding that to the lexicon that people will now know. But I want to hear from you some of the things that you are hopeful about, some of the things that bring you joy in the communities that you are involved in, and then some of the things that you recommend people do. We have a couple, places to go, things to learn and videos to watch, but some of the things that really bring you joy so that people can understand more about why it's so important and who you are and how you bring yourself to here. Is that okay, Mel? I really wanted to have the conversation there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think one of the main things that gives me hope is the tribal resources being put towards saving the language. For a lot of our tribes, because the language is the tie that binds many of us. And so we have many immersion schools that are happening now where children will enter into elementary school and be learning their native language. And they go home and teach their parents.
Awesome.
Because the parents weren't taught it because their parents were what? Beaten for it. So the parents didn't want to teach their children and have them go through it. So we have a generation or two that doesn't know our language. But our children are now bringing it back into the home and reintroducing it. And it's being funded and supported and nurtured. That is incredibly hopeful. I think also seeing ourselves tell the stories in media, like Reservation Dogs and Dark Winds and these different television shows that are now produced by natives and have
in front of and behind the screen. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's like if the lion didn't make it, then it would only be the hunter's story.
Mm-hmm.
There's lions that made it. And yeah. we're getting to tell our story in our way. And what it's doing is not ostracizing the dominant culture, but it's inviting them in to learn what are some of our slang words, you know, what, so everything is not enemy, you know, militaristic, stand up against, but it's like, are you curious about who we are? This is who we are. When we say Skoden, that means let's go then. You know, we say Studis, that means let's do this.
Do this.
So, you know, those type of things. And we're getting younger generations of the dominant culture who are coming in and wanting to really learn and having yeah. respect for our culture, whereas their generations before never even saw us in the light that we have now. That's encouraging. And then seeing white folk, black folk, Hispanic folk, gay folk, anybody standing with us in protest against like the Dakota Access Pipeline. That gives me hope because we don't have enough people. There's not enough of us left to fight this dragon. And we need everybody's help. And everybody has shown up on these lines from all different walks of life. They haven't had to be convinced. They haven't had to say, well, I don't understand your culture, but I guess I'll stand here. They want to be there. They're sacrificing. And what it's doing is reinvigorating Indigenous people to empower ourselves, but to also mm-hmm. trust those who don't look like us again. And I cannot tell you how powerful and hopeful that is. I don't want our children to grow up being suspicious, excuse me, of every person who doesn't look stereotypical Indigenous. We have to live together and we have to defend the sacred. So that's how I would like to end the conversation, with those hopeful pieces, and that those continue, the language, the media, and then the people showing up for not only our rights, but human rights,
right?
Earth rights.
Yes.
That's all of our futures. So we got to stick together in that. And Native people are not savages. We are not uncivilized. We're the ones who welcomed the stranger. Mm-hmm. We didn't wipe out millions of us, yet we were called the savages.
Exactly.
So just try to understand the narrative differently as you move forward and take it a day at a time. Use the resources that Tashelle and others have shared for you to research. And also, I mean, another great movie is Neither Wolf Nor Dog. Neither Wolf Nor Dog. That is an incredible story. And that will enlighten you to Indigenous elders, our way of looking at Earth, and our way of looking at life.
I thank you for the education you provided to our listeners, to us, and so generously. I can see and feel, really feel, your passion and your culture come through. I mean, I always have, and I always get, whenever I've never gotten to listen to Gator talk for this long, and I'm just as blown away as when he talks for even just a short time. I'm so thankful to know you, stand beside you, fight with you, joy, laugh with you as well. I'm so grateful. I could say this forever. Go ahead, Mel.
Absolutely. So I was going to say top of mind. My top of mind is very much tied into what you were just talking about, Gator. I guess my one of my really big takeaways from this, and something I want to remind all of us non-Native folks, is when you interact at all with Native people, be really aware of whether or not you are consuming that versus building a relationship. It's a completely different mindset. Consuming is capitalistic colonizing, right? And like, I think a lot of times people are really like, oh, well, how do I like appreciate versus appropriate? Like, I feel like sometimes we ask that question is like, how can I ethically consume Native culture versus how can I build a relationship and get to know people and build community with Native people? That's a completely different mindset. And it involves earth justice, and it involves, you know, social justice. It involves all of this stuff. Instead of just saying like, what can I get away with? think, how can I actually build community and start thinking as a we instead of an I? And the other thing that you said so many incredible things that I'm going to be chewing on for weeks, I'm sure. But you mentioned a lot of media and TV shows and films that I really appreciate, because I think when, again, we'll call it dominant culture, is interacting with minorities at all, it's often considered like woke points to like, oh yeah, I saw 12 Years a Slave, right? And it's good to watch films like that. However, you also need to get out of like the suffering porn genre and actually engage with other creative types of media that we're getting away from the stories that are, excuse that term. I know, Tyshel, you just made a face. I'm sorry.
I was thinking about yeah. all of the movies that center whiteness
or center the pain of minorities and the pain mm-hmm. of the struggle, which is important to know the stories, but also watch Black Panther, watch the creative stuff, watch the futuristic, the vision mm-hmm. casting, the how could life be different, the creative stories, the fiction, engage with fiction that's not just centered around suffering, because there's a lot of cool stuff out there. So I really appreciate that you mentioned a lot of those. I was writing them down. I'm going to go watch those shows and movies now. So thank you so much for that. Top of mind for either of you.
I'll go top of mind and I'll let Gator finish with his what's top of mind. I said this in the beginning and then Gator said it too. I'm a lifelong learner, so I've gotten a small course in so much of what Gator is talking about, but it is not the only, Gator's not the only person, he's not the only source, so I need to keep doing my own research and listening to Indigenous creators. There are podcasts out there, there are books out there, there are things you can watch to just laugh, because Indigenous people telling Indigenous stories. There are things you can listen to learn and all of those things. For me, what's top of mind is continuing that education, continuing the engagement, getting to know people. And all of the, when we read, one of the things that struck me that I'm thinking about too, is when we read Gator's bio, you have so many facets, right? Being an Indigenous person is the core of that. But you have a husband, a father, a pastor, all of these facets, and not looking at anybody as one dimensional. But I love that you stand on it. You know, we say in the Black community, we stand 10 toes down on who we are, and that being the core of who you are and everything emanating for that. So I know that not just because I want to be right, but I know that what I said in the beginning is so true. You speak with such power and such peace about who you are. And I don't even know if it's top of, it's just all of the things that you said are top of mind for me. So much buzzing around and just thanks. So Gator, what's top of mind for you right now?
I think top of mind for me is simply having the ability to share openly with two people who are different than me, but who are also like me, and having that human connection that can spur thoughts, ponderings, struggles as people grow and I grow and y'all grow. That's top of mind right now. These conversations are sacred. And they are for our culture and they are for all cultures. Even when your own culture is telling you something else is sacred, you know, when we talk like this, you feel that connection. And you understand that the human connection is really the basis for love and compassion. That's top of mind for me right now.
It's so, there's just so much. And I just think about that, because we, even in this conversation, it's this cyclical understanding of being fed, right? We have this conversation. I know more, you know more, we all know more, right? But we've created community just having this conversation. And that's really, when you think about all of who you are, and I'm just saying this to our listeners, and who you really are at your core, it's really wanting to be communal. And I encourage dominant culture and white folks to really investigate who they are at their core, because so many folks, and this is when we talk about cultural appropriation and when we tell you every year not to dress up in a costume, it's really you searching for this cultural connection. Yeah. And have it, you just have to dig deep. And when you see it on folks like Gator and myself, it's because we're still connected.
That's right.
Really. And we live that connection, that community. And if you go really search for what's deep inside of you that you had to give up to become whiter, to become a part of a dominant culture, you can get back to that and you can emanate and the community will feel just right in having these conversations. So,
yeah. One more thing.
Well, I want to say,
this might be one of our longest episodes, but it's okay. For those of you who want to get more involved in Native issues and Native rights, but you're like nervous, like, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to, you know, I don't know. Go ask Native people and follow their leadership. It's very simple. So you don't have to guess. You go ask and they'll tell you exactly how you can help. So it doesn't have to be rocket science. So
as we follow the leadership. As we wrap up, one thing that we didn't get to talk about, and this was, we spent more time talking about this in the beginning, is I really want people to go look up and learn the story of Wounded Knee. We didn't get to talk about it because we talked about so many other things for an hour and a half. But I really want people to go look up, learn, watch short videos because, you know, our attention span is really short, but go watch some videos and learn about it so you can get this breath of understanding and history. And I just want to say thank you to our listeners again. Thank you to Gator. I can't think of another thing because it would be 10 more things. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Gator. This has been awesome.
Thank you.
Exactly. And see you all in 2 weeks.
See you soon.
Thank you.
Where's the video? This always sneaks.
We have an outro.
And then we have an outro video. And I'm always like, where is it? Okay, here's the link. Okay, bye everybody.
Bye, y'all.